In most of the battery tests that are now set up in psychology, the Rorschach test is included. This test consists of presenting the subject with a series of inkblot designs, or designs based upon the original inkblot concept. Usually a piece of paper was taken and folded, and with a very soft and flowing pen, some word or signature was written along the fold. Then, without blotting, the two pieces of paper were brought together, and part of the design appeared on the opposite fold. When this was opened up, it resulted in a more or less symmetrical pattern. Very often this was enlarged or amplified by various devices, but the patterns were nearly always symmetrical. That is, similar on the two vertical sides of the pattern. This type of testing presented the subject with a series of comparatively meaningless blots. But very seldom did the subject ever leave them meaningless. He began to interpret what he saw. Well, in a good many cases, these ink blots did form a rather interesting designs, frequently with close resemblance to some familiar object. Very often, however, the subject rejected the familiar object interpretation entirely. And if you showed the ink blot to 100 different persons, you would get a great number of different explanations of what it looked like. To some, this ink blot would resemble simply a mask or face made symmetrical by the two sides having been blotted one upon the other. To another person, this blot took on a very strange, morbid meaning. One individual saw the laughing clown's face, and another a death head, in exactly the same example. The point we want to make out of all of this is that unknown designs, patterns for which no fixed interpretation is given, are subject to interpretation by the person viewing them, examining them. And this interpretation comes essentially from within himself. Seldom, if ever, does it actually arise from a factual level of understanding. The mere circumstance that the thing is mysterious or unlabeled takes away certainty and gives freer expression to our imagination. The person looking at the Rorschach ink blot is quite aware of these certainties or these circumstances. He is not likely to be greatly deceived. He knows he is being tested. And if he is entirely honest and wishes to cooperate, he will describe the figures or designs which are most apparent to him. Not long ago, an art exhibit was held in one of our communities of rather, I would say, not too good art. Those who came to see it were invited to make their selection of the best picture, write it on a slip of paper and deposit it in a box, the purpose being to get some concept of public taste, or perhaps to influence the final balloting for an award that was to be given. When the ballots were examined afterwards, of the hundreds of persons that had come in to see this particular exhibition, the choices were so diversified that someone had considered each picture as the best. No one asked which one was the worst. It would have produced exactly the same type of circumstance. To someone, each picture would also have been the worst. In the understanding of this, we therefore have to realize that what we call taste may not be merely a gracious standard of psychological understanding. Taste is really an expression of certain pressures and instincts within ourselves. All these tests lead to the ethical conclusion that the individual lives in a world which he interprets very largely according to his own internal pressure. As world is mystery, as other people are mysterious, so we are forever imposing an interpretation upon them. This interpretation becomes more complicated if we come under psychic stress. The most obvious normal thing to do in the Rorschach testing or in any other test is that the person should see the object in its most obvious and evident shape and form. If the object to a small child, to 100 children, would all look like a bird, or would seem to be a bird to all of them, it would mean that the ink blot in its own formation actually approached the general appearance of a bird. It would be the natural conclusion, the obvious conclusion. If, therefore, the person comes to that conclusion with the majority who agree with him, then he may be regarded as not under any particular or peculiar distortion. But if he comes to some entirely contrary conclusion, one in which others cannot see the slightest resemblance between the ink blot and what he feels it to mean, then we suspect that he is under some rather peculiar pressure. Now let's bring this down to a more personal level. We each of us have persons around us. Each of us also has unfinished business on various levels of conduct. Most of this unfinished business has a mystery about it because we do not know exactly how it is going to come out. We plan, we hope, we prepare, but we are never certain until certain things happen. Thus we are under a certain natural stress or tension. Then with persons, we gradually come to realize that we cannot simply look at the person and decide what he is. We come to know that his kindly look may or may not be supported by his temperament. We realize that his word may be his bond and it may be worthless. He tells us that he is most sincere in his regard, but we are not certain. Later we may learn that we have been deceived and imposed upon. Thus, out of gradual experience, we come to the conclusion that we cannot entirely accept people. We cannot entirely say to ourselves, this man says he's good, therefore he is good. When we start saying that now, we're liable to be poorer rather quickly thereafter. Thus, the definition, the signboard, the name, which would make all things obvious, cannot be hung on things anymore as a certain label of their meaning or value. We see articles with guarantees. We do not trust the guarantees anymore. We hear that a certain product is of superior quality. We do not believe it anymore. Thus, the more common ways in which we came to conclusions have failed. And everything we are in contact with takes on the element of mystery. What is it really worth? What does it really represent? What does this other person really think? Is this political party really progressive? And all these doubts throw us away from the ability to make simple acceptances or rejections. Each of these uncertainties lures a psychic content out of ourselves. Each one of these problems and each of these people becomes in its own turn a sort of Rorschach test. A test in which we are constantly trying to penetrate into meaning, trying to discover the answer to a puzzle, the puzzle of value, the puzzle of integrity, the puzzle of character, as represented in other objects and persons. And having no true scale by which to measure these uncertainties, we do not measure them at all. We simply impose our own psychic life upon them. As soon as we do this, we reveal not what they are, but what we are. Once this has been accomplished, we begin to treat these other objects or persons according to our own expectancy of them. If we have decided they were bad, we proceed to dislike them. If we decide that they are good, we proceed to like them. This, in turn, may lead to a series of deceits. We may discover the persons that we did not like were really admirable persons, whereas our selection of the persons we do like may be so weakened by our own psychology that we select the worst of all people and are very soon injured or disillusioned by their actions. Having been disillusioned, we then turn upon these other persons, completely oblivious to the fact that we have empowered them to do this to us. We are the ones that have invested these other persons with virtues which perhaps they never claimed, or with temperaments which they never possessed or imagined that they possessed. But if these expectations of our own do not work out, then they are to blame. We are miserable. The bottom is out of our moral and ethical universe. It consequently comes to our attention, rather forcibly these days, that this projection of ourselves, our internal content, upon exterior objects can be dangerous. It can lead us to a whole series of disasters, and is perhaps merely another manifestation of the operation of the law of cause and effect in nature. The individual who has not organized his own life projects disorder upon everything around him, then must live under the disorder which he has projected. The moment we have decided what something is, we act accordingly and set up a new series of relationships. We give this thing which we have defined and perhaps almost created the right to have certain distinct reactions upon us. We are open to all of the reversals of emotion and thought which arise from a wrong estimation in the first place. This wrong estimation would not have been possible had we possessed the facts. But in very few problems do we possess the facts. What we call a fact is our own interpretation of the subject. The person reading one of his own designs into a Rorschach blot, ink blot, is perfectly certain that he has read into that its real meaning. The next person, coming to an entirely different conclusion, is quite certain that that is the real meaning, until the analyst in the end finally comes to conclude that for very few persons is the real meaning of anything evident. That what we know as real meaning is our own personal reaction. Unreal meaning is someone else's reaction. This reaction is obviously false because it does not agree with ours, and ours is real. This can go on to infinity without any real grounds for moderation or for common understanding or for mutual respect on these decisions. This again merely tells us the tremendous power of our own psychic integration to influence our estimation of values. It does not mean that this integration actually causes us to change anything else. The person whom we interpret according to our interpretation is not actually changed in any way by what we think about them. There might be some ethical modification if this person feels that we have unusual confidence in them. They might rise to that confidence or try to. Or if we dislike them, they might make no effort to be pleasant. These generalities can follow. But essentially, our attitude toward anything makes no essential change in that thing. The painting at the exhibition was no better and no worse because we liked it or disliked it. It remained whatever it was. Because we have no means of changing these things, the relationships which are set up from our own interpretation of something else means that our own attitude is reflected back upon us from this thing upon which we have bestowed an interpretation. We are immediately affected by this in the term of our own preconception. It must be what we expect it to be. And the most terrible disaster of all is the discovery that our expectancy is wrong. This strikes us at the root because it assails our own egoism. The idea that we could be wrong is so abhorrent to us that we will use every device possible to relieve ourselves of this morbid possibility. To do this, we continue to heap responsibility, guilt, or blame upon the other object, convinced that we have been right in the first place, and therefore that this other person must have some strange magical power to change itself or himself so as to hurt us or to bring us misery or loss. If this is a fact, and we know that it is a fact, the greatest of all of the Rorschach inkblots that we have to work with is the world itself, the universe, the atomic age, the pressures of industry, our continual impact with things that are pleasant or unpleasant, our interpretation of radio and television programs, our interpretation of music and art, our interpretation of the newspaper, of crime, of all kinds of activities. All these interpretations arise in us. And while there are certain moral truths involved in all of these problems, it is surprising to the degree that we can completely overlook the facts. The person who is under any psychic pressure or tension has a tendency to evade facts, because the end of all fact is to bring our lesson back to ourselves, and that's where we do not want it to be. So we have a skill, an incredible skill, in justifying our own misinterpretations of the things that happen to us. We justify by means of a certain dishonesty in our own natures. And wherever there is psychic pressure, there is some degree of dishonesty, conscious or unconscious. The individual who is under tension simply is not honest. This doesn't mean he will steal anything or that he will intentionally break a law. but it means he is not honest in the estimation of his own relationships with other things, or even his relationships with himself. The moment we find pressure, we find antagonisms, we find criticism, we find antagonism between ideas, which is just as difficult as between persons. We find conflict and prejudice. We find intolerance. And we come upon these things working to hurt persons, and they do not realize that they are suffering from these ailments. They honestly believe that they see the thing as it is. Now, if you were to go to a series of battery tests on something, and you took 10 tests to determine, for instance, a degree of natural optimism, and if in these 10 tests, in each instance, your interpretation followed a pessimistic trend, in other words, if you always saw a negative in a symbol, if a symbol always became a cause of fear or regret or doubt or antagonism or depression, and you went through this battery of tests and came to the end of it, you might say to yourself, that's rather funny. Here are all kinds of things that really have no meaning in themselves at all, and they all look unpleasant to me. You might even say to yourself, I'm beginning to suspect there might be something wrong with me. It's conceivable. Because this is such a nice, neat little scientific package, I have no way, essentially, of evading the fact that I've come to very negative conclusions. But if the same person out in life, going through the years, comes to 1,000 negative conclusions over the period of entire lifetime, and lives the whole of his career emphasizing negation and cheerfully overlooking anything good, it doesn't occur to him that there's a thing wrong with him. It's just the fact the world isn't as good as it used to be. And he wishes he had those good old days 40 years ago, and he forgets he was just as miserable then. But because now it is no longer in the laboratory, and it's out in life, and it's with people and objects and a kaleidoscopic mingling of values, he no longer considers it likely that his own vision is astigmatic in any way. Now it is just the fact that life is that way, just plain miserable. He should take a hint from others, for he sees around him every day persons going through the same general types of experiences that he is going through. They do not seem to be miserable. At least some of them do not. He finds persons enjoying things he dislikes. This has no general effect upon him. These other people simply have no sense, or they have bad taste. It's still the fact that he is a really serious fellow. He's thought it all through carefully, and he's come to the conclusion that everything is wrong. And if you try to tell him to the contrary, you are wrong, and join the great circle of things against which he builds defenses. Out of all of these psychological testings, therefore, we come to certain general, common, human facts, which can be a great deal of help to us. Suppose we also now say that the person who sees things wrong all the time has to have something negative inside, something terribly lacking in normal optimism. Let us also say that the person even becomes aware of this. But he sort of sits down, opens his hands and his lap and says, what can I do about it? How can I change the fact that this is the way it really seems to be? Everything I come in contact with proves again and again that my worst suspicions are correct. You can sit down and talk with these persons, and sometimes, in a few instances, where you have one of commanding intellectual ability, you may be able to convince them that it has been a bad matter of perspective, that they simply lost sight of the values in things. But you can seldom, if ever, talk a human being out of a good, solid emotional despondency. Not only is he unwilling to change, he is unable to change. His very despondency has destroyed his own psychic power of recuperation. And if you finally do convince him that he is wrong, then he collapses more than ever. And he may turn to you with the saddest of all expressions and say, well, if I'm wrong, then I've always been wrong. Now I've wasted a whole life being wrong, and I feel worse finding this out than I did before. You can't win against a good, solid, negative determination to be miserable. Yet if you ask these persons if they want to be miserable, they say, of course not. Who does? We want to be happy, but we can't find anything that justifies our hope that we ever will be happy. And then will come perhaps the unloading of the sad story of the dozen or half dozen disasters in life by means of which our hope for happiness has been destroyed. Yet we have to go on living, and the problem of continuing in a state of perpetual misery is not very intriguing or very optimistic. Persons, therefore, who have these kinds of problems sometimes have to enter into a little conspiracy with themselves about their own problem. What we feel, how we interpret, how we react, all of these reflexes, to a measure at least, depend upon a psychic chemistry within ourselves, a chemistry which assumes alchemical, mystical proportions. We are not of the attitude which we presently hold because of one faculty, one emotional instinct, one habit, or one degree of understanding, or even as the result of one problem. All that we are inside is a compound consisting of numerous elements brought together to form a unit or an integration, a bundle made up of numerous sticks or twigs or materials held together with a string which in this case represents the intellectual coordination. Being therefore of our present mood, because of a confusion of complicated circumstances, it is almost useless to head into this mood, decide that it is wrong, and resolve to defeat it if it requires our last ounce of energy. It will, and we will still not be victorious. If, as we are beginning to recognize pretty seriously nowadays, this person who does the judging, who passes judgment upon the forms presented by the Roshoff inkblots, if this person was one faculty, one power, one emotion, one point of view, we could head into it hard and perhaps break through it and relieve the pressure. But this pressure arises from as many mysteries on the inside as the reaction arises from mysteries on the outside. The person going down into himself does not find a hard core of pressure. The cause of pressure slowly disappears from his awareness when he seeks to explore it. He gets further and further in and comes finally to a kind of hole in the dark. And out of this hole in the dark, these pressures are pouring. But he can never get at their cause. He can never find out just exactly what thing he did that sets all this pressure mechanism into action. The reason he cannot find the single cause is the fact that there is not a single cause. A series of conditions have all worked together to produce a reaction focus. Now, this focus, in its turn, may be affected by single causes. The individual going out in life seeking to build a home may have a marriage with a person whom they were emotionally drawn to, and in 3 months the marriage is on the rocks. Now, the marriage going on the rocks and the circumstances relating to it can cause an obvious center of pressure. This center of pressure may in turn result in fear or resentment and cause the person's emotional life to be upset for the rest of his present embodiment. This can happen. But the shock of the bad marriage was not the cause of the situation or the condition. The real cause lay in the type of persons drawn together. And this drawing together on a certain level arose from the pressure integrations of the involved individuals. The bad choice in the first place, perhaps against the advice of those who knew better, perhaps even against the recognition within ourselves that it could be a mistake, perhaps inspired by an ulterior motive, a girl simply wanting to get away from home, perhaps one looking for only economic support. Any one of a dozen ulterior motives can do it. But behind the bad marriage, there was bad integration. There was something wrong. The marriage itself, going bad afterward, results in a new chain of circumstances. But the original cause was much deeper than an incident. One of the simplest things you can say about it was that somebody misjudged someone else. It was a mistaken case of judgment. And a mistaken case of judgment in this type of problem is too often the same thing that we have mentioned. The individual simply seeing himself reflected from another person. Under emotional pressure also, where the rational factors are not as active as they may be in other levels of thinking, it is particularly easy to let psychic pressure take over. And the individual forms violent attachments or antagonisms, which have no actual grounds in fact, reality, or common sense. To go further, then, we have the person who is moving out from a kind of compound within himself, a compound composed of at least 40 mental, emotional factors. In addition to these, numerous other hypermental factors going far back and deep, about which we have very little knowledge today. But suddenly out of this entire compound comes the personality to which we conveniently attach the label Joe Doakes. So we meet Joe, and Joe is just a good fellow. Joe is this kind of a fellow and that kind of a fellow. Joe is a fellow that if you treat him pretty decently, will treat you pretty decently. If you kind of agree with him most of the time, he will agree with you once in a while, which is considered liberality. Joe's got a quick temper, but he gets over it quickly. He's a bit of a worrier, but naturally rather cheerful. He likes to work, not very hard, but he will still make a living if he has to. And out of this whole situation comes this sort of general compromise personality, good old Joe, who is like a million other good old Joes. So we come along with this person, and we try to say that this part of his temperament is weak, that part of his temperament is weak, one of these days he may meet up with some kindly lady who will try to strengthen all his weak points and weaken all his strong points. This is in order to make something really worthwhile out of poor old Joe. So life goes this way, but where are the roots of this thing? They're not in this good old Joe estimation that we have. They go very far back into the most atavistic recesses of existence. They go back to the earth and the stars and the air and all of these things. The roots of this problem are far deeper than we can ever reach. And if it's hard for us to ever understand Joe, it is harder for Joe ever to understand himself. So we come upon him and his problems. And the idea that he is simply a piece of paper with a pattern on it, which we can erase and put another pattern in its place, is wrong. It is not this way. Nor is it a pattern in which we can say to Joe, this particular habit of yours is doing you no good, why not cultivate one that will do you good? So he sincerely tries, and he's more miserable than he was in the first place. The pattern is so complicated that whether it is our own or someone else's, there is no direct, head-on attack which will succeed in actually varying or altering the basic temperament of the person. Now, the person can have many temperaments, but they can be divided perhaps into three general classifications. He can have a temperament that is essentially cheerful, in which good cheer will be victorious over dilemma. He has an essentially melancholy temperament, in which things will always seem a little dark or dismal to him. And optimism will be a very difficult attitude which he cannot maintain continuously. Then there will be others, a third group, which seems to be a sort of middle group, in which things that happen have very little apparent effect at all. This person can live long and learn nothing. He can go through all kinds of experiences and not become aware of any pattern in any of them. And he may be sufficiently superficial so that to him nothing becomes very good or very bad. To try to get at this, then, means a very careful estimation of our own character and a determination to approach it not head on to a difficulty, but in the realization of this compound problem. A compound is totally altered if any of its elements be changed. And a compound is something in which you do not have to destroy the compound to change it. Any change alters the compound. And if the compound is made up of 100 elements, and you change one of these elements, the other 99 remaining the same, still the compound is changed. This is a very important point, it seems to me, in working with people. We have tried to make great big plans. We have set out patterns and procedures. And we say, this individual should start by taking hold of this problem or that problem. So we try to indoctrinate, and we try to encourage, and we try to enlighten. And things go on very much the same. Because every person is defensive in his belief that whatever he believes is so. And while he may be forced to admit that his judgment isn't the best, it's hard to get him to admit that a painful experience was not painful. He will tell you he knows more about it than you do. It happened to him. If, on the other hand, you can begin this problem with dispositional subjects of breaking through the shells of compounds, helping them to be reorganized on other levels, Now, you may be reasonably satisfied with your own temperament. It may be getting you by fairly well. But there are very few persons whose dispositions or attitudes could not be improved in some way. And I think we should bear in mind that this program of improvement in some way has much to do with the program of happiness which we hope to enjoy. Few persons are as happy as they theoretically believe that they could be. They are living on levels of contentment that fall short of happiness. Perhaps they are living on a level of patience, an acceptance level. They are not doing what they want to do, but they're trying to be grateful that they're getting by. All such persons could certainly be happier if they went to work on the matter industriously. Also, we have a certain area of defense against certain areas of pressure. An individual who is an habitual liar, for example, has a tremendous defense. He has been called a liar so often, he has called himself that in the quietude of his own thinking so often, that he builds an almost impervious capsule around the entire pattern that is causing the trouble. He will fight to the death to prevent anyone from breaking that up. Not consciously, maybe he wants to recover, but it is like a very sore place on the body. And when the physician tries to rub that sore area, we tell him not to rub too hard. And the discomfort that arises from attacking a fault at its very core is too great for most people. They begin to wince, and they don't go back to the physician again if they can help it. So it is much easier not to make this head-on rush into a difficult pattern. So if you have within yourself any character defect whatsoever, of course I realize that here we're a pretty perfect group of folks, outstanding in our attainments. But if there is a vestige, a residual atom, that is not quite as it should be, why, there's always something we can do about it. Forget this entire head-on into gloom. Forget the fact that everything wrong has happened. Don't try to tell yourself all the time it was just your fault. That won't do it either. You can get so hang-dogged in the presence of yourself that you hardly want to keep on living. Forget it all for the moment and begin to think of how the chemistry itself can be changed.